Welcome to this special encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour as we revisit our favorite arts and culture conversations from the year, Crazy Rich Asians came out about a year ago, and it made $25 million on its opening weekend and hit number one at the box office. We're going to talk about its impact on Asian American representation in mainstream media. But first, 39% of couples who have gotten married in the past decade are in interfaith marriages. It's a pretty big departure from a few generations earlier. In the 60s, that number was less than 20%. That's according to Pew Research. The numbers are even higher for Jewish communities. More than half of all Jewish people who've been married over the past two decades are in relationships with non-Jewish partners. That, and the question of whether or not you have to choose a religion when it comes to raising your kids, is the subject of a Chicago documentary, Leaps of Faiths.
One thing that always frustrated me about religion is that it divides people.
People who are of various traditions fall in love.
Jews and non-Jews, and then they ask, well, now what are we going to do?
So many people are in interfaith marriages, interfaith relationships.
The majority of American Jews are partnered with someone not Jewish. There are more children growing up in a home with one Jewish parent than with two.
This is something that we've definitely discussed and worried about.
If you're interested in watching Leaps of Faiths, the documentary is available online. We'll have all of the information up at our website at 21stshow.org. But for more on it, we're joined now by co-writers and director David Kovacs and Steve Ordower. David, Steve, thanks for being with us, and welcome to The 21st.
Oh, pleasure to be here.
Good to talk to you.
David, I wonder if we can start with you and ask why you were interested in this topic and making a film about interfaith relationships and families.
Sure, Nyla. My wife and I have been married 32 years. She's Catholic. I'm Jewish. And we've been part of the formation of some groups and a unique kind of religious education program in Chicago where parents teach their children both their faith traditions. And we just kept seeing amazing moments of connection and clarity and wrestling with some of these issues that Steve, who's a documentary filmmaker, I'm a writer, we said, I think there's a documentary here.
And so that's the Interfaith Family School, David. That's what you're talking about, right?
Right. It's we call it the Family School. If you see it online, it's the Chicago Interfaith Family School. And there's another school called the Union School in Mount Prospect, a suburb of Chicago. So there are two schools in the Chicago area.
So that's really what this documentary focuses on. As we talk to David and Steve, I want to invite all of you listening, especially if you're in an interfaith marriage, we'd love to hear what sort of challenges you face. You can text us your thoughts at 217-394-5765. We'll read them on the air. Again, that's 217-394-5765. Don't forget to include your first name and your hometown. So, Steve, you guys are talking to a lot. You talked to lots of different people that are involved with this interfaith, with the family school. And I think it's interesting to me that in the documentary, it seems like the couples are pretty open to figuring this out, but maybe it's the others around them who are not, whether that's more times than not their families or perhaps sometimes religious leaders. Did you find that was the case with a lot of the folks that you guys interviewed?
Well, you know, it's interesting because what I found to be so inspiring about this story was that when you know, oftentimes people will pick a spouse based on their circumstances or conventional wisdom or the societal, you know, paradigms that they live among or within. But with these couples, that's quite the opposite. They've chosen someone really powerfully, despite what the rest of society or their family members or their friends say about everything that can go wrong. And they have to be very proactive in not only loving another person, but accepting them and creating their world from that point of view, as opposed to, does this person fit into my predetermined boxes? And what's so inspiring about that is that most of these couples have stayed together for quite a long time, and their relationships are very strong because they're grounded in like genuine acceptance, not the type of acceptance people think they're engaging in oftentimes, but you know, it's got to be real, because there's no way your relationship can last if you're married to somebody from another cultural group. And you know, the religious divide is one of the hardest barriers to cross. But when you're married to somebody, you can't. It's not going to last unless there's some real acceptance happening.
David, I wonder how we see that acceptance, how that works with the family school. Can you tell us about how it works with how this got started and what kind of things people do?
Sure. And it really gets into the larger question of, you know, as the numbers you quoted, there are so many interfaith families, and they all make different choices. Some choose to raise their children Jewish. Some choose to raise their children Christian. Some say that, well, kind of be culturally religious, but we're not going to have religion in the family. Mm-hmm. And there are some people who've said, well, what about this learning two faiths? So when the family school started, it was a small group of families, seven families, and that kind of underscores the importance of community. People have asked us in other cities, how can we start this? Can we homeschool our kids? Send us the curriculum, and we're happy to share what we do. But, you know, there's really this community element of kids learning together side by side that is sort of the magic of how this happens, and the fact that we couldn't really hire a Jewish teacher and a Catholic teacher in the very beginning to teach these classes. It had to be the parents. And because the parents teach together, they're learning right along with the kids. So it really kind of unfolds through our kindergarten through eighth grade curriculum. And as a result, these kids, and there's, you see them in the film, we have a video of them in eighth grade talking about what it's been like to learn these two faiths, what it is to explain to other people, you know, how their religious outlook looks. And then because the school's been around for 25 years, we have kids in their 20s who've grown up. We hear them in eighth grade, and then we hear them in their 20s. Mm-hmm. And it's powerful to hear how people's how they look at life and religion and, you know, these deeper questions. It changes as they grow.
Right.
Yeah,
so,
and I just wanted to add to that, if I may. That was also one of the most inspiring parts of the story, because it gives me hope for the future, listening to these young people coming up and how their way they view the world in terms of their critical analysis is really wonderful to see.
And so now you guys have Father John Cusick, Rabbi Alan Setcher, who are working with you all now. How do you handle, as you're talking about the inspiration that you have from these kids, David, I wonder how you do talk about the really hard questions here about the theological differences between Catholicism and Judaism to start with.
Right, Nyla. And you know, we also have Rabbi Evan Moffick and Rabbi Ari Moffick and other rabbis and priests who are in the film who've worked with us. And, you know, Rabbi Evan Moffick is very clear, in articulating the theological differences and that they're real. And you can't just push them aside. And Will, one of our students who's grown up into his 20s, makes that point very clear. And he and Anna, his classmate from years ago, kind of get into an interesting discussion about it. You know, how do you wrestle with the theological differences, and are they important? And so, that's the way that we tried to, you know, be true documentarians here and show the different dimensions of these questions, and that, you know, this is really about wrestling, and in the wrestling is what's fascinating.
Yeah, and it's a productive wrestling. It's a productive questioning. It's a productive learning and growing. And so as opposed to, you know, putting aside the differences, we welcome them. And that's what we set out to document.
And then the last thing I'll add is, we kind of were selfish in making this film because we've been curious. How do these kids grow up? Did we do the right thing by making the choice we made of how to raise our kids? And we kind of were rolling the dice saying, well, we'll teach in the choices we made. We'll teach them both faiths. We'll let them self-identify religiously as they grow older. And it'll be up to them to decide what their religious path is in life. And so by putting them on camera and asking them those questions, we kind of got some answers that we're excited to share with everybody.
And I want to go back to one of the things you were talking about, David. You were mentioning some of the now young people who have gone through this, and you mentioned Anna. I mean, when you think about the fact that these young people that you guys have helped raise up, to have these in this religious environment to sort of whether they're in, you know, it's all about the choices and also how they're deciding to have their religious beliefs and their spirituality. Obviously, that doesn't stop people from passing judgment on that. And I wanted to just play a little bit of Anna from the film talking about she's 23 now and reflecting on some things that happened to her, particularly when she was in Israel.
I took a trip to Israel with my parents and my grandparents. My grandma was a spy during World War II, Jewish spy, so she's a survivor. We were at dinner one night with our tour guide, and eventually he like turns to me and starts asking me questions about what's like what I believe. He's like, "Well, you're not full Jewish, you're half Jewish." And eventually he looks at me and goes, "Oh, well, you know you're Hitler's success, right? Like, you're not a Jew." And that will stick with me for the rest of my life.
That's Anna from the film Leaps of Faith, the documentary. We're speaking with co-producers, directors, David Kovacs and Steve Ordower. So, I mean, that's really tough to hear. And I think that's maybe something that a lot of these families have to deal with maybe on different levels. Steve, I wonder how often you found, as you were also in this community, that people were dealing with situations like this.
Well, you know, this is what was so interesting about documenting this story, is because in the adult educational conversations that we'd have among the parents, the honesty was so striking. And the stories, albeit different, you know, to whatever degree, there were a lot of similar patterns in terms of judgments passed, particularly from the family members. That's where most of the judgment came from.
And you mean outside of the core unit of the family,
oh,
right?
Oh, like outside?
Grandparents, aunts and uncles, those sorts of, yeah.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's interesting. I've been a bit, David would probably be better to answer that, because my kids don't know any other reality. And they're younger than David's kids. They're 12 and 9. So, you know, they, you know, some people ask them some questions, but they go to public schools. And David, why don't you speak to that?
Yeah, my kids are 30 and 27, and they've always considered themselves both Jewish and Catholic. And it's interesting, that quote that you played of Anna, the next thing she says, I'm a full Jew and a full Catholic. Some kids describe themselves, I'm half Jewish and half Catholic or Christian. I think when our kids went out into the world, like many teenagers and young adults, they said, well, you know, I mean, my daughter's into theater, my son's into music. That's their religion. That's their community. That's what, you know, drives them and answers some of the larger existential questions in their life. But now that my son's married for 4 years, my daughter's engaged, the people that they meet, my son married a woman who is Catholic, so they'll probably have more of a Catholic way of living their life, but they're never going to lose the Jewish part. And I think kids, especially millennials, have such an ability to, you know, live in more than one world. And that's kind of where our kids are.
We just have a minute or two left, but David, I do wonder, I mean, we started this conversation looking at the demographic trends and how much this is just really a becoming a much more common reflection of society, of interfaith families. What are you hoping people take from this documentary?
Well, I hope that people will find their own stories, whether, again, regardless of how you raise your kids, there are different pathways through here, and they're all valid if they work for your family. I would hope that people find their story and are able to share it with other people and to say, let's build a community in our area of interfaith families. Let's let our kids play with each other and realize that they're not different. They're similar. And let's, I think community is so important. And for people who would say that this is about, you know, the what about the future of the Jewish community, I would say, and I know Steve would say too, look at all these Christian people that in our just in our community alone who've gotten to know Judaism on this incredibly personal and deep level and feel when there's marching in Charlottesville about anti-Semites. They feel it just as Jewish people do. And there's a place for them in the Jewish community.
Leaps of Faiths is available online. We'll have that information up at our website at 21stshow.org. We were speaking with David Kovacs and Steve Ordower, writers and co-directors of the documentary. We'll be back after this quick break. Stay close. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
I want money.
1.2 million.
That's what I want.
The Nick you're dating is Nick Young?
Yeah, you guys know them or something?
Hells yeah. They're just the biggest developers in all of Singapore.
That's what I
want. Damn, Rachel. It's like the Asian Bachelor.
These people aren't just rich. They're crazy rich.
Now you really should have told me that you're like the Prince William of Asia.
That's ridiculous. Much more of a Harry.
Last summer, Crazy Rich Asians hit the box office. It was based on the best-selling book by Kevin Kwan of the same name, and since then, the movie has grossed more than $230 million worldwide. Its all-Asian cast is rare in the American film business, especially big-budget Hollywood movies. It's basically been 25 years since the last one, The Joy Luck Club. It also stands out as a romantic comedy. You heard a little bit about the Prince Harry of Asia in this movie, Nicholas Yeung, and the way he and other male lead actors are portrayed is pretty different from how we usually see Asians, and especially Asian men, in movies and TV. When the film first came out last August, we had a chance to speak with Kerry Chow. He's a writer for The Undefeated. You may have also seen him on SportsCenter, where he was ESPN's first Chinese-American broadcaster for that show. Jeff Yang also joined us. He's a contributor for CNN and a columnist for the South China Morning Post. His son is also Hudson Yang, one of the stars of ABC's Fresh Off the Boat. Kerry, Jeff, welcome to The 21st.
Hey.
Yeah, pleasure to be here.
So let's start with the whole idea, guys, of Crazy Rich Asians being basically a romantic comedy. And I think lots of moviegoers will see some familiar beats in that sense. It was very interesting for me to watch this. I've seen this twice now. Kerry, you and I actually saw it together for the first time when we were in Houston with Asian American journalists, right? And then I saw it again this past weekend, and it was interesting how different audiences reacted differently to it. But what do you guys think of, first of all, just the whole idea of Crazy Rich Asians? I've heard some ideas of this being like, this is the Asian Black Panther. Jeff, do you think that's an appropriate analogy?
I don't think it is in any way except for the fact that this, like Black Panther was for African Americans, and frankly, for all of us who appreciate diversity in Hollywood, was something hugely anticipated and aspirational. Crazy Rich Asians does build on that. It extends the idea that just maybe people who don't look like everybody else that we've seen for the past three generations on screen can make movies that are fun and entertaining and commercially successful is actually a reality. But this is something very different from Black Panther. And in that sense, I mean, it sort of identifies the fact that stories that are about diverse audiences can and should go in different places.
Mm-hmm. Kerry, why do you think it's significant that this is also has an all-Asian cast in this genre of romantic comedies?
Well, it's been, as you mentioned before, since 1993, a major Hollywood studio has not had a film featuring an all-Asian cast. And you mentioned already about the Asian male specifically. Asian males have predominantly been portrayed as these emasculated, desexualized individuals. And it's not so much about this, oh, we want to look sexy on screen, but it's no, actually it's about how that affects the psyche of the young Asian American and how that can impact. Pop culture has such a tremendous impact on how we on our self-esteem, on confidence, things like that, on our identity. And I think that's where the big difference is, where this movie finally portrays the Asian male as not just this Long Duk Dong character, which so many of us are familiar with from 16 Candles, but actually as a normal person. We don't have to be portrayed as these crazy, sexy individuals. It's just a normal three-dimensional person is truly what we've been asking for such a long time.
And I will say there are a lot of very sexy men in this, and it's kind of an interesting romantic comedy in that sense too, where the men are very clearly objectified. There's lots of shirtless men in this. There are not very many scantily clad women, which is, I think, also an unusual thing for this genre. But Carrie, you wrote about this whole idea of what this meant to you. And I, when you look back on it, you mentioned 16 Candles. When you look back on your life, there's a great piece that Carrie wrote about this. We'll tweet it out. He wrote about this for The Undefeated. What do you think your life would have been like, or would it have been different if you saw more Asian men on TV and in movies when you were growing up?
Yeah, I think a lot of us who are hyphenated Americans, whether it be Chinese American, Indian American, whatever, Mexican American, if you see yourself when you grow up in a predominantly white culture, white neighborhood, and that's where I grew up. I grew up in Orange County, and a lot of people think of OC as this Asian-filled area. Well, not what I grew up in. Specifically, like, there's communities, right? And if your specific community, I was surrounded by mostly white friends, and that is, I truly did enjoy my childhood. But the problem is my urge to assimilate came at the expense of the pride in my identity, the pride in my culture. I resented a lot of Chinese culture. I didn't learn the language. And part of that was because, oh, that's Chinese. That's the otherness. And a lot of Asian Americans are familiar with this concept of this perpetual foreigner syndrome, is that no matter what someone, when someone sees us, they always see an outsider. They don't see an American. And growing up, I tried so hard to be that American, and it hurt. And when finally you get to this point where you quote unquote become an adult, right, and you look back at your life and you look at the things in which your shortcomings, I look at the fact that I had so much resentment towards my culture that it really affected me, and I didn't want other future generations to have that same effect. And I think a lot of that comes from pop culture, and because maybe I'm in media, and that's why I maybe overemphasize media's influence. But I know for a fact when I'm watching a movie, and the only way I'm portrayed is this nerdy, asexualized, emasculated individual, it does subconsciously affect me and growing up. And that's why I felt it was so important for this movie to kind of change that perception.
Yeah. And I think I would say, I mean, to that point, Carrie, as you're sharing your stories, I'm just thinking about when I was a kid being embarrassed at having an Indian name and not wanting my name to be Nyla Boodoo. you go through a process, right, where you become comfortable with it. And then eventually you're not only just comfortable with it, you're proud of it and it's your name. Jeff, what do you think? I wonder what you think about your childhood and growing up, and as Carrie sharing his stories, what you want to share with us.
Yeah, well, I also belong to a generation that was traumatized by 16 Candles. But I will say this, it was perhaps for a slightly different reason. And that's because as much as I get, you know, people's concerns about the sort of nerdy Asian stereotype, the reality is this, I look a lot more like Long Duk Dong than I look like the ab-fantastic folks in Crazy Rich Asian. And it wasn't really so much the notion of physical appearance per se, because the honest reality, you know, if we can accept it, is that the character of Long Duk Dong and Getty Watanabe, who played him, actually, I mean, was kind of a scene stealer, right? It's just that he was a scene stealer in a way that presented us as aliens, as bizarre exotic creatures who did not belong in America. And I think actually the thing that's so quintessentially interesting about the path that John Chu took in adapting Crazy Rich Asians was he turned a story that is set in Asia, largely with Asian characters, you know, in Singapore, right? And he made it an Asian American story. He really centered on this tale of Rachel Chu, this immigrant, you know, daughter of a single mother from America coming to this world which was not her own, really highlighting that sense of being different in America and also kind of different in Asia. And that spoke to me. I think that the normalization of us as Asian Americans and as Asian American men as well is very much about recognizing that, yes, we can come in all different looks and flavors and, you know, shades and orientations, but at the end of the day, we're humans and we're attractive, appealing, funny, smart, interesting, and yes, occasionally incredibly fit humans.
Well, the Hollywood version, right? We're talking with Jeff Yang, who's a CNN contributor and columnist for the South China Morning Post's Inkstone magazine. Carrie Chow's with us as well. He's a writer for The Undefeated. Carrie, you spoke to John Chu about this, the director of Crazy Rich Asians. What did he have to say about how he, what he, the kind of thought that went into how he portrayed this novel?
You know, we had a, I was fascinated by John because I think he also shared a lot of similarities in which he had mentioned he's been in Hollywood for a while now. He said this was his eighth film, and he started reflecting about, he started seeing Constance Wu discuss the whitewashing of characters, like in Ghost in the Shell and those types of instances. And he said he was upset. He's like, damn it, Hollywood, how is this happening? I'm paraphrasing here, but then he thought, oh crap, I'm part of Hollywood. What can I do to change it? And so he sought out Crazy Rich Asians, and he wanted to make sure that it was this authentic, and to what Jeff is talking about and what I'd alluded to, these three-dimensional Asian characters. And that's what's so important. It doesn't have to be this crazy, sexy Asian. It just has to be a three-dimensional human that people can relate to. And that's what he wanted to emphasize when he first got attracted to the project, was about how the Rachel Chu character, the Constance Wu character, was an Asian American, and he'd always thought, hey, am I Asian enough? And he really connected to the fact that she was going back to Asia, and it was this dynamic which was really reflected well in Fresh off the Boat, in this incident in which the family alluded to, hey, we're like Patrick Swayze in Ghost. We're caught between these two worlds. Are we Asian American or are we Asian? When we're in America, often people look at us as Asian. When we're abroad, everyone looks at us as American. So we're caught in this weird dynamic, and it affects this your identity. And that's what really attracted him to it. And he's like, this is a universal story that any hyphenated American or any child of immigrants can really understand, because you are caught in these two different worlds.
And I wonder also if we could just talk about not just those two different worlds, but then also the whole financial side of this. Jeff, I wonder how much you were holding your breath this weekend to see how well it did at the box office, because everyone's sort of thinking this is before the movie has even really, we haven't gotten to the very lucrative Asian market. It'll be interesting to see that part. But just how you thought this opening weekend went in terms of now sort of the storyline this Monday is this is a win for diversity and for Hollywood, and showing, to your point, that these movies can actually make a lot of money.
Well, I mean, it earned $34 million, which was basically more than triple earliest projections for the film. Basically an A++++, e.g., my parents would say it met expectations. But the reality is we live in an era in which we're seeing more and more films by and about and starring people of color come in and sort of emerge as these surprise, quote unquote, hits, exceeding expectations. And I think that what that really represents is Hollywood's lack of real understanding of how the demographic is shifting, of how Hispanics and Asian Americans and African Americans are literally the ticket buying audience now, punching above their weight in not just purchasing, but also amplifying films. So you see things like Girls Trip and, you know, now, of course, Crazy Rich Asians and, you know, Get Out and Black Panther even, right, coming out and just crushing it. And people saying, oh, my God, who could have predicted that happen? You know, well, everybody could if you actually looked at the results of the last decade or so. So, yes, on the one hand, it's great to see Crazy Rich Asians, you know, kind of crush these expectations. But the fact is, this is about a demand that's being unmet by Hollywood. And it's about the fact that Hollywood doesn't promote, publicize, or even develop films and stories like this at a fast enough rate to feed the changing of America.
And there's an interesting story, right? There's an interesting storyline here too, Jeff, right? About the fact that Netflix actually offered John Chu a deal to have this go straight to Netflix, and they actually turned that down to gamble on having a box office open because they wanted to show they wanted to show exactly what you were just talking about.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a famous story at this point. Netflix gave them an offer that was more lucrative than they could have imagined, but it would have landed this film on a streaming platform that it might have even been seen by more people. But the context of people being willing to take money out of their wallets to pay for this movie specifically is something which they believed America needed to see. They believed that there needed to be proof on the paper, literally, that Asian Americans can be seen. And that's what this movie has delivered.
Jeff, your son. Oh, go ahead, Carrie. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, to piggyback on that same concept, so John Chu had mentioned to me, he's like, there's a huge message that is sent when that big studio deems your story worthy enough of our financial backing. And not only if Warner Brothers or whatever the distributor is who puts that money forth, the other big distributors, the other big studios are also noticing that and are recognizing, okay, hey, they're putting their money where their mouth is. Maybe that's something that we need to start to internalize as well. Because for the longest time, and I also spoke with one of the producers of the film who had mentioned, Nina Jacobson,
yeah.
Sorry. Yeah, who produced The Hunger Games. She had mentioned for the longest time in Hollywood, promoting diversity was seen as the right thing. But what they're starting to finally realize, and it takes them a long time, as people have mentioned, Hollywood is slow to come to these terms. But now diversity is the profitable thing. And ultimately, that's all that really matters in Hollywood.
Can I ask both of you, Jeff, I mentioned this at the beginning, your son is Hudson Yang, one of the stars of ABC's Fresh Off the Boat. It's certainly a very different media landscape for him and his generation. For both of you, we just have a minute or so left here. What kinds of stories would you like to see, particularly about Asian American men in the years ahead?
I mean, I'd like to really see stories that take us beyond simply, the relationship world and into one where we're dimensionalized as fathers, you know, and as sons, right? I think there have been a lot of stories about mothers and daughters, understandably. I think that might be a little bit of a gap. And I'm actually really looking forward to John Cho's upcoming film, Searching, which is all about him as a father looking for his daughter.
Carrie, we just have about a minute left.
Yeah, I agree with about Searching, by the way. I definitely want to see that. I'm going to go ahead and say that you made the comparison to Asian Black Panther. I want to see a superhero. I want to see that Asian American superhero, and I want to see a big budget. So the Incredible Hulk on the comic books nowadays, which is authored by Greg Pak, that character is now Korean American. Hey, let's see that on the big screen. Why not? Let's dream big and then see what happens.
That's Carrie Chow with The Undefeated. We were also speaking with Jeff Yang, a contributor for CNN and columnist for the South China Morning Post, about Crazy Rich Asians and Asian American representation in the film. We have to take a quick break, but we'll be back in just a minute. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. With summer wrapping up, we've been thinking back about some of our favorite live shows of the summer. Seeing Yo-Yo Ma at Millennium Park in June was definitely the highlight of my summer music experience. But if you're looking for new bands and festivals to check out, it can be hard to find the right thing. Between huge festivals, underground dives, and everything in between, where should you start? Back in June, we sat down with Sean Newman. He's a freelance journalist based in Chicago. He's written for Rolling Stone, Vice, and Chicago Reader, among others, and he plays in the Chicago bands Jupiter Styles and Rap Boys, and he's an alumni of The 21st, one of our former producers. Hey, Sean, thanks for being
hey,
here.
It's really good to see you again.
Welcome back to The 21st.
Thanks.
So when we think about Chicago, there are places to see music every night, especially over the summer. Mm-hmm. How do you decide who you want to see? And I remember when you lived in Champaign-Urbana, how did you decide, like, I want to go back to Chicago for this?
Sure, yeah, it's really difficult because there's so many options. I mean, there's so many free free shows. There's so many awesome shows of bands coming through town and touring through town. But there's just a vast wealth of a local scene here, too.
So how do you decide? Do you feel like, do you tend to go with people you know? Or are you open to just kind of a venue where you think, like, I like this venue. Maybe I'm going to like hearing somebody new here.
Sure. I mean, like playing in the Chicago music scene, too, like a lot of friends of mine will recommend bands that are coming through or be like, oh, my friend's band is playing at this thing, you should check it out and stuff like that. But I also really like going to shows by myself because you kind of are vulnerable and get to meet a lot of people because you're forced to talk to people around you in the crowd and stuff like that. And it's also, if you really just want to focus on the music, you don't have to talk to anybody and you can focus on the music and just have a good time.
So what are some of your favorite venues for that in Chicago?
Subterranean's a really good place. There's a lot of local bands that play there and also a lot of really good bands in other local scenes around the country that come through to tour there. It's kind of like a launching pad for a lot of younger bands. They have a downstairs room that's kind of just like a classic dingy Chicago bar. It's really dark and stuff like that. And then there's a big upstairs room that fits like maybe 400 people or so. So you can see a really great show there too.
So Sean, I think lots of people are familiar with festivals like Lollapalooza or Pitchfork, but you wrote about Chicago artists who are playing other festivals this year who might fly under the radar, right? Who should we be looking for?
Yeah, there's a lot of great local bands that are kind of becoming a thing, or local artists that are just getting to grow legs and just like take off in Chicago and starting to tour around the country and the world too. Some of my favorite people, if you remember Namdi Obanaya, who has been
on the 21st, yeah, introduced us to.
Yeah, he played drums in this band Options that was on the 21st probably about like 2 years ago or so.
Yeah.
They came in studio and played. But he has his own music under his own name, Namdi Obanaya. And he just makes kind of like weird like rock mixed with like goofy hip hop and stuff. It's just a really unique type of music that I haven't heard before anywhere else. And he's always doing stuff. He's playing West Fest this year on 4th of July weekend. And there's a bunch of other bands. Tasha, who kind of plays this like jazzy laid back music. She self-describes it as like bedtime music.
And she's at Pitchfork this
year. Yeah, and she's playing at Pitchfork, I believe, Saturday. She's one of the first acts that'll play during the day. So one of my favorite things with Pitchfork or Lollapalooza or Riot Fest, which is becoming a bigger thing, is that they do put a lot of focus in getting local Chicago acts to play earlier in the day. So if you get there earlier, say like Pitchfork starts at like 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock.
Which no one gets there that early.
Yeah,
normally.
But you should. You definitely should, because there's a lot of really, really great bands that you'll find that just live down the street and you could see them at places like Subterranean.
Speaking of Tasha, she was featured in a piece you wrote for Time Out Chicago about seven Chicago musicians you're looking forward to seeing this summer. Who else made that list?
There's a few bands on there. It goes from things like Tasha, who's kind of can play solo or with like a backing band that's kind of, like I said, more jazzy and more like reserved and calm sounding. But then there's like really hectic hardcore punk bands like this band Chew that just, they're really loud. They're really kind of just like let loose and the shows are really wacky and stuff. There's also this band Beach Bunny that I think we'll hear later in this segment that is just kind of the epitome of like summer music in Chicago, very poppy and very like clean sounding and just like just really warm and bright. So that's a great band. This band La 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 is taking off really well. They play just like kind of a lot of rock music and the lyrics are very like heavy and introspective and stuff. So it's a great listen.
So maybe we should take a listen to some of this. Let's hear from Tasha. Alone at Last is her album. It came out last year.
Yeah, yeah, it's great.
And this is Kind of Love?
Yes, the fourth track on the album.
Have I made it long enough to say, far enough to show? Here I am, a grinning girl. And what is all your golden light for, if not to sing about? Just when I needed a moonbeam, look at what I found. And this is
That was Tasha from the album Alone at Last, Kind of Love. She is playing at Pitchfork. Sean Newman is in studio with me, freelance Chicago journalist, covers the music scene, plays in the music scene. He's plays for Jupiter Styles and Rap Boys in Chicago, and we're talking about some of his favorite bands he's excited about seeing this summer. You mentioned Beach Bunny, and I wanted to ask you about them because actually, is it Lily? Is it Trifilio?
Yes, yeah.
So she's 22 from DePaul?
Yeah, yeah. They're DePaul students. That's why it's like so exciting, and they've got a lot of buzz around them too, is because they're a younger band that sounds so mature and so good right now. So when you can just kind of sense when a band's going to take off, and they're already taking off.
So their big song right now is called Prom Queen?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's take a listen to that.
They say beauty is pain. You'll only be happy if you look a certain way. I wanna be okay. I wanna be okay.
That's Summer Prom Queen from Beach Bunny. We're talking about Chicago music with Sean Newman. So, Sean, when we're thinking about summer, the great thing is it's kind of summer in Illinois. Everyone loves all of the outdoor
concerts.
Right. They're 3 weeks of outdoor concerts. But, I mean, they're great shows at Millennium Park. There are street festivals, block parties. Are there other ones that you're kind of keeping an eye on that might be a good, especially if we're thinking about people worth the trip to come to Chicago to see it?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of smaller kind of bars that, like this place called The Native, it's in Logan Square, that has music every single Sunday. I mean, there's acoustic acts from a lot of great bands. Bands like Sincere Engineer, which is this kind of like loud folk punk band. They'll play a like quieter acoustic set, and you can just kind of sit outside on the patio and drink beer and just watch them play. And it's really intimate, and you get to see a really special thing because you get to see these really good Chicago bands that are very popular and, like, you know, like I said, like kind of taking off around the country and around the world, and they're playing this intimate acoustic set. It's really special.
And so when you think about that, I wonder for you, what are kind of the elements of what makes a great outdoor concert? It's hard, right? Because the ones that you remember that you just think these were so great.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of goofy because a lot of it depends on the weather. I mean, if you have really good weather, then you're going to have a great time kind of no matter what. So it's funny how it's sometimes doesn't even have to do with the music. That's not like the biggest factor. It's just like if you catch a good day, a good Chicago summer day, which is kind of rare sometimes. So.
And when you're performing, does it make a difference to you guys if you're performing at a festival versus like an indoor venue? Do you feel like it's a different feel?
Sure, yeah. I mean, thinking about like we've played South by Southwest a bunch of times, and this past year we got to play on some outdoor stages, and I'd never really thought about it, but then when you're playing outside and there's like a breeze and it's really like, you know, the sun is shining bright and everyone just seems like they're having a good time, that kind of energy, there's just like something so natural and beautiful about like how the weather impacts everyone's mood. And I don't know, playing outdoors, like you were talking about Millennium Park, like I have really distinct memories from taking the train up to Chicago. I grew up on like the suburbs in the South Side, and you'd take the train up to Chicago every Monday for a free show when we were off school, and you didn't have to pay. You could just sit in the grass and watch these really awesome musicians, like really big musicians. Like this year, there's Car Seat Headrest coming by and Natalie Prass and stuff, like people that are constantly on the radio and stuff. And so you get to see these really cool acts for free, and you get to sit in the grass with your friends and watch music. It's really beautiful.
Not exactly the genre, but Yo-Yo Ma is also playing at the
awesome.
Millennium Park,
like,
this summer.
That's such an incredible opportunity.
Really looking forward to that. No,
sure. Well, a living legend.
Yeah, and my niece was like, I was trying to convince her to go, and she's really young, and she's like, I can't go because I can't sit quietly. And I was like, actually, it's in the park.
Yeah,
so you don't have to sit
play
quietly.
Play frisbee, yeah.
Right. So we've been talking a lot about Chicago. I wonder who else you're listening to outside of Chicago right now.
Oh, boy. I'm biased because we get to tour with a lot of really great musicians, but some of our best friends in this band Wild Pink out of New York, they make some of the most incredibly like textured and beautiful music, and it just like creates an atmosphere and you get lost in it. I've had like experiences driving into the city of Chicago, coming home from tour, and you know, you see this giant skyline, it's like 3 a.m. and you see all these bright lights, and there's this like really atmospheric music playing with friends that you've been on tour with and stuff. And I went to Europe with them for an entire month, and they're like, some of my best friends. And so that band has a really special hold in my heart, and I think they're great and one of the best bands in the world. They're Wild Pink from New York City.
All right, so we'll listen to Wild Pink as we go out here, but I want to thank Sean Newman for being with us. Not just he's a freelance journalist, but he's also in a couple of Chicago bands, including Jupiter Styles and Rap Boys. Sean, thanks for being with me. Thanks for coming back to the 21st.
It's great to see you.
Lovers lock it in the window next door, the neighbor's 93. Run around the town that I come from, raiding carambola trees. I believe that there's a ledger somewhere, somewhere that days go. They say don't think about it all so much, don't take it so bad. Thought I was toast, it was a panic attack. Didn't I mean, yes I did. Hiding out in the native flora there, just trying not to take it so bad.
That does it for us today. You can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. We're also on Facebook. If you want to search there for the 21st, you can like us, and it's another way to comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, if you want to leave us a voicemail as well, send us an email, or remember our social media handles, all you have to remember is our website. That's 21stshow.org. We've also got all of our past shows archived there. You can find us also most places you get your podcasts. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, NPR One. Search for The 21ST. We're produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.